Well, hello and welcome to the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
Podcast!
Hey! I'm Brian McKenna, I'm the Business Applications Editor at Computer Weekly. I'm sitting in at the home of Computer Weekly near Shoreditch. And I have with me two colleagues.
Caroline Donnelly, I'm the Senior Editor at Computer Weekly.
I'm Claire McDonald, I'm the Business Editor at Computer Weekly.
Cool. So, Caroline, you're just back from Barcelona.
Yes.
You've been looking at a beautiful data centre.
Yes, my first press trip of 2019.
First of many.
Yeah, I know. Straight out the gates in early January, or end of January, actually. But yeah, it was a good trip. It is apparently voted the world's most beautiful data centre, and I've been to quite a few, and I do believe that... I don't want to run it down. It's very nice. It's in a converted 19th century Catholic church, and there's all the servers are in a big glass box within the confines of this church, so it's really, really striking. There's pillars everywhere, there's stained glass windows. Yeah, so it's not obviously your average data centre.
Did you say that it was in a cathedral?
Yeah.
So it's like the data centre of the gods.
Yeah. So it's within the grounds of the Polytechnic University of Catalonia. So it's not just dumped in some random cathedral somewhere in the middle of Barcelona, but it's kind of like a place where potentially you could do a lot of... Well, they're doing a lot of good work there around genomics, around climate change data analytics, and I think astrophysics as well. But yeah, it's a really impressive facility. It's totally... I go to... The usual data centres I go to are on the Slough Trading Estate or next to the Hayes Bypass in West London. So yeah, you know, in that context, it's beautiful. But I haven't been to all of them, so I wouldn't want to put my hand down now and go, yeah, it's the most beautiful one I've ever been to.
And what's the supplier? Who owns it?
Well, it's a mix of technologies in there, but it was Lenovo who took us there because there's a lot of Lenovo technologies in there at the minute because Lenovo acquired IBM's server business a couple of years ago, so it's kind of the event itself is a bit of a state of the nation for Lenovo, really, around kind of this is us, we are a data center company now. We're not just, you know, PCs and mobile devices and things like that, so it's a bit of a grand unveiling almost for them. And you know, it's a huge deal, this data center, in terms of, like I say, the work that's going on there, the types of workloads that are being processed there. And just in terms of if you're going to showcase a customer, it is an amazing looking data centre.
Yeah.
And probably one of the best facts, there's two things that kind of stood out for me, is because it's within this university, they are really encouraging children and women in STEM and things like that. They're really opening it up for people to have tours of it because it is so striking, but at the same time, try and get more exposure of what data centres are and hopefully encourage more people to work in data centres.
Into the business.
Yeah, exactly, which I thought things are a really good idea. Usually they're such kind of secretive places, they don't want anybody in and that kind of thing. So this was quite interesting as well.
They can be a bit of a black box. You don't really understand what goes on in them and therefore you don't understand what kind of career you could have near them.
Exactly that. And
isn't there a Dan Brown connection?
That was going to be my second...
That was going to be my second
amazing fact about this place. That apparently it is featured in a Dan Brown novel, which I am going to confess I've never read. Not a big Dan Brown fan. It's called Origin, the book, and apparently the data centre is called the Barcelona Supercomputing Centre, and that features in the book. I don't know if it's...
The data centre or just the cathedral?
The data centre.
Right. Yeah. So he actually mentions it.
Okay. Yeah, so that's, you know...
Look at that.
I'm going to be doing a photo story on it this week, so I'll have all these facts and probably loads more on Computer Weekly.
Pretty pictures to look at.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's the picture goes, I think, maybe 12, 13 other journalists on this trip, so some of my pictures I'm going to have to properly edit because it's in this glass box, so there's lots of reflections in my picture, so it looks a bit like it's haunted. You can just see people sort of standing behind me, so I need to sort those out. But yeah, that will be on Computer Weekly hopefully next week.
Ghost in the data centre.
Ghost in the data centre. That'd be my Dan Brown novel. There you go.
So you escaped the weather this week. Claire, you haven't. But you've been out and about in London.
I did manage to get out and about. I was concerned that the tube wouldn't be running in my neck of the woods because of the snow, but luckily it was.
Snowgeddon.
Snowgeddon, yeah. Not like last year. So earlier this week I was at an event, a BRC event, about future retail leaders and the types of skills that they'll need in an increasingly digital world. it was quite interesting. There were representatives from Marks and Spencer and John Lewis there talking about their career paths, the kinds of skills that they have developed over their careers from being bobbies in retail to now being, you know, high flyers in the space. It was one of the only panels that I've been to where it seemed accidentally to be all women rather than to have been sought out to be all women.
Right.
It wasn't specifically tech focused, but I think the whole point of it was you can't really talk about the future of skills in retail without talking about digital capabilities as well. So yeah, they were saying adaptability and soft skills quite important, and I'll be writing that up next week so you can all read a little bit more about that.
Cool.
So that was cool.
And speaking of retail.
Yes,
indeed.
I've been encroaching on your territory as business editor. I'm sorry. Yeah, I apologise now.
We discussed. I forgave.
it's an interesting story. There's a big software as a service. I need to remember all the words for this. It's a software as a service based e-commerce platform provider called BigCommerce. So there's lots of repetition in there, and I apologise. But they announced this week that they are moving 60,000 of the merchants that use this platform.
And they're called BigCommerce.
Yes. So they're moving 60,000 of the merchants that use their platform to conduct online sales and things like that. They're moving them from... Well, it's the back-end infrastructure that supports them. That's moving from IBM SoftLayer to the Google Cloud Platform. They use a little bit of AWS as well for when peak traffic happens. So they burst into the AWS cloud. But they're moving from IBM and AWS to the Google Cloud Platform. And this is quite interesting because stories where someone has ditched one supplier for another are always quite juicy.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone
else meet and drink for PC.
Yeah, exactly. But what's quite interesting here is the company itself, the software as a service, so they're already big on cloud, but they're doubling down on a different cloud provider than the ones they've already used.
Right.
So it's kind of like, so they've already got an existing relationship, a business relationship with IBM. They've already got one with AWS. So they're deciding we want to do more, we're going to go bigger on cloud, but we're going to use a completely different provider we've not used previously. So I thought that was quite interesting.
So did they give any reasoning behind that?
They did. They said it is because Google's network infrastructure is international, and they said it's a bit more robust. They've got more presence, as it were, across the world than IBM and Amazon. I can't verify if that is true or not.
But that is what they said.
That's what they've said. Because with it being retail and online, they're saying they want to give customers a fast, responsive website. They want them to be able to make their sales really, really quickly. Mm-hmm. So by relying on Google's network, they've got more points of presence throughout the world.
Mm.
So therefore, you will get faster and more responsive websites and things like that for them to use, for customers to benefit from. So for them, it's all about low latency, fast performance, and they've gone with Google because they say they can do that better than the other two. So it's an interesting story. I was talking to an analyst this week on similar stuff like this called Nick Maguire from CCS Insights, and he said we'll probably see more trends like this where companies, particularly in retail but also maybe in other industries as well, where they will start off on their cloud journey with maybe a couple of different providers just as they're kicking the tyres on various things. And then something will happen as the digital transformation journey continues where they think, okay, maybe... Rather than going with all these different providers, maybe there's one that can really do what we need them to do. Or it might be an economical decision, it might be cost-driven, or it might be, as was the case here, something to do with performance, that by investing more money in one provider rather than going with a few, they get better performance somewhere along the line. So it's a trend I think we'll see playing out. Like I say, it's their bread and butter stories for Computer Weekly when someone ditches one supplier for another, so that'd be quite interesting.
Caroline, do you ever come across Oracle in this battle of the clouds?
I'll tell you what, I'm not sure if I should say this on the podcast or not, but whenever I always share the stories I've written on LinkedIn, and on LinkedIn you can get a bit of a drill down as to who's read the stories you've posted on there. Where do the people work? You don't get who exactly are these people, but where do they work? Whenever I post anything about Amazon or Google, it's always Oracle people who are in the most, the people who've read this most. Yeah, so obviously...
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so that's very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Oracle's pitch in all of this, and this maybe fits into the narrative of, you know, kind of becoming more sophisticated and more mature, is they would say, we really, like, say, financial services, if you're a big bank, we really understand financial services, we really understand your business, AWS, Google, not a chance.
On that point as well, there does seem to be this trend of larger software companies buying up niche other smaller companies that have a specific focus on something that they don't already do. Salesforce buying up Demandware and then rebranding it the Salesforce Commerce Cloud, and Oracle buying up NetSuite, for example, who have quite a lot of retail-focused
and
customers.
And also Dyn. Who provided a bit of the Oracle Cloud infrastructure that they couldn't develop themselves, so they just acquired Dyn.
There is a bit of a trend towards that as well, which ties into your point about just choosing one provider that can do everything that you don't already do or can't implement yourself.
Yeah, I think going back to the Oracle side of things, what is quite interesting is Amazon and Google, if we use those as examples, they're both companies that have had big consumer brands, aren't they? So their background is in either book selling, in Amazon's case, or providing consumer
search,
consumer internet services to people. So organisations like Oracle have previously kind of used that as a bit of a stick to be Amazon and Google with, like, we're a kind of enterprise heritage brand, we know what CIOs want, we know what your security concerns are, what your privacy concerns are, what you're after. These guys don't know about it.
Absolutely, yeah.
So over the last couple of years, Amazon and Google have been working tirelessly to ensure that that kind of criticism can't be levelled at them anymore. They've invested lots in making their platforms and services
there for the
ready.
Enterprise, there for big companies. Interestingly, this week I published an interview I did at the end of last year with Adam Selipsky, who spent 11 years at AWS.
I was going to say, I recognise the name.
Yeah, he really helped to build that business in the first place. He is now the CEO of Tableau, who are the kind of data visualization software provider, and along with Qlik, almost synonymous with data visualization. And they have been really accused, I suppose, by IT departments over the years of having kind of land and expand strategy, which they do have. So they'll find, you know, a bunch of data enthusiasts in a marketing department who will download Tableau, and then it will begin to its incursions into the enterprise, much to the annoyance of corporate IT. Is a bit of a theme. Now, Tableau, I mean, anyone who's been to a Tableau conference will tell you how evangelical it is. I mean, these guys really love data.
They're like well into it.
Yeah, and there is a lot of love for Tableau and for Qlik in the market, no doubt about that. But I was asking Adam Selipsky about this, and I do know a lot of very senior data professionals and IT professionals who will say, Tableau, it's cool, I like it myself, but it's not an enterprise tool, stop. Mm. They don't understand the enterprise. But Selipsky says that Tableau has been very much on a kind of multi-year journey to make themselves not just land and expand, but also what he called discover and descend.
Okay.
So that the two meet in the middle somewhere.
Yeah.
And he says, look, I have lots of conversations with CIOs and heads of BI and senior architects and CISOs, etc. But he acknowledges it can be a problem, because in the end, a chief information officer or a chief security officer can just say, no, we're not doing that. It's an interesting interview. And the other very interesting thing that he said, I thought, was about, he had this analogy with Microsoft Word. And he said that maybe 20 years ago, people would, 25 years ago, people would get themselves certified as Microsoft Word users. I know, it's funny, it's funny, isn't it? But he said that in the future, data visualization tools will be a bit like that. They will be ubiquitous, more and more people will use them. Anyway, I mean, that's his story. I thought it was an interesting analogy, and he made the basic point that maybe in 5 to 10 years' time, we'll look back and we'll say, God, in 2018, 19, we had such a long way to go with data analytics in terms of things like natural language processing for accessing this kind of software, machine learning to make it better and more automatic, and things like that. So it's an ongoing business versus IT versus IT story.
So is this land and expand thing, so is it the data scientists are almost kind of making Tableau happen at a grassroots level, and then it's getting on the radar?
Absolutely,
it's like a shadow IT thing almost as well.
Yeah, it's definitely a shadow IT thing, and or has been historically at least. Salipsky also made the point that really senior people like CIOs like to kind of implement software that is beloved by users because you know they don't want the problem of shelfware of software actually not being used, because that's not a good investment for them either. But anyway, speaking of IT and the business, been a bit of an issue this week, hasn't there, with the court system?
There has. So this was covered earlier this week by our colleague Liz Evanstad, who's the management editor at Computer Weekly. So apparently the HM Courts and Tribunal Service has had some major IT problems. People haven't been able to access their phones, the computers, email, and it's been causing some major delays within the courts. They've ruled out the possibility of it being some kind of cyber attack.
Yeah. So that's why it's your first question.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Someone is due in court today, just thinks, right, I'm going to take this down.
So they don't think that it was a hack. As far as I'm aware, there wasn't really a confirmation about what did cause it. So they've been working with their technology suppliers, Atos and Microsoft, to try and fix the issues, and some stuff is back online, some places are able to access the systems and some aren't. They've denied that there have been delays in letting people out of prison as a result of their IT failures, but...
What about getting people into prison?
Yeah, exactly.
The whole business of justice.
Yeah.
And that secret barrister guy, he tweeted about this.
Yeah,
he
did. And
it may not be a guy, it could be.
Well, could it's be a girl. Secret barrister.
Unconscious bias, which we're going to touch on again later if I have anything to say about it.
Bad Brian.
I did it earlier, don't worry.
So, yeah, didn't he say something like, if this was the National Health Service,
it'd
be up in arms,
exactly.
Because it's just justice.
Yeah, just justice. Yeah, he said, if it had been the NHS, everybody would be talking about it.
Mm.
But it's sort of been kept on the down low because...
Mm. The first I heard of it was, actually on my flight to Barcelona, and I looked over the shoulder of someone reading the paper next to me, and I was like, oh, I hope someone in the office is writing that. I'm on my way to Barcelona.
Well, Liz had it covered.
Yeah, nice one, Liz.
Also on government IT, we haven't mentioned the dreaded B word yet. Ugh. I'm just about to do so.
Oh, come on. We were doing
so
well.
We've got so far into it without any one mention of that.
It has been a bit of an interlude this week, but there's another big vote on Tuesday. But no, this is more to do with poor civil servants in the Department for Culture, Media and also Sport. Apparently the digital identity team has been moved off doing what they were doing around digital identity, and they're the team that's been doing the Verify scheme, but they've been basically put on Brexit duties for the time being.
Yeah, reallocated.
They've been reallocated. Also the Information Commissioner's Office, one of their representatives, Jonathan Bamford, who's Director of Strategic Policy at the Information Commissioner's Office. Warwick Ashford, our security editor, reported on a any Westminster Forum event at which this guy from the ICO said, prepare for no deal Brexit. Because we're all, I think there's a general confidence that there probably would have been a data adequacy decision saying that Britain is, or the UK is fine for data privacy. Which is kind of ironic because a lot of the kind of good things around data privacy have actually come from the UK in the first place. But we need this data adequacy agreement because we've become a third country. And that, you might assume that at least that would be in place by the time we leave, if we do leave on the 29th of March. But the plan was to sort that thing out during, if not before the 29th of March, during the transition period that ends in December 2020. So the Information Commissioner's Office is warning firms and telling them, you know, get ready for a no-deal Brexit. I know there was stuff this morning about aeroplanes and trucks, but...
Well, they're just going to fall out of the sky.
You know, data's our thing.
I think maybe just, maybe just not being able to take off rather than falling.
Oh, okay, cool.
If you're on, like, a midnight flight on March 28th into 29th...
How long until we see a headline like, New Millennium Bug?
Well, I think we've already had...
Have we?
Also, we're not... At least it's been likened to it in some quarters, but... We're just so ill-prepared. And like that, like the story about them having to pull people off government projects to go and work, it just seems like it seems quite late in the day to be doing that now. Shouldn't this have started, you know, in preparation at least 2 years ago, some of this stuff? It feels like no one's really thought about it and they're having to rush.
Well, it feels like everybody was surprised when it was announced that we would be leaving the EU. It's almost like the government went, oh... Okay.
Yeah, and then...
Quick.
Yeah, it's...
Implement some stuff.
Yeah, but then I guess we are in completely uncharted water.
Mm-hmm.
No one... We've never tried to leave the EU before. We obviously don't know.
Well, exactly. No one has.
And there wasn't this level of data and digital technology to consider.
And there's the whole matter, something that came up at this event, of not knowing where your data is necessarily.
Mm.
Yeah.
Especially with the move to cloud computing.
Yeah, what does that mean for people who have data within the EU once we leave?
Yeah, we have had... I've been speaking to data centre contacts. There has been, it sounds like, an increase in appetite from businesses located in the UK or overseas businesses about bringing data back onshore to the UK because of concerns around this.
Mm.
If you know, if you're a UK business and you've got customer data being stored in Germany or wherever or some other European country, it's like, once we leave the EU, are we still okay to transfer that or use it or
get it back?
So at the moment there's a lot of preparation into companies thinking, right, we better bring it back, better talk to our local friendly co-location provider and see if they've got some space for us to use.
Well, after all of that, let's turn to the topic of wine.
Yeah, I think we need some after that.
I wrote a case study recently on Majestic Wine, and I wrote it at the start. I started writing it at the start of Dry January, and it was the worst thing to do when you're thinking, like, don't think about wine, think about all your soft drink options. And every other word in this case study was wine and drink and just, and don't you have a great time with wine? Like, yeah, you do, usually. Yeah. So... yeah, that aside, although I wrote it, I will say this, it's an interesting story. It's retail again. So, sorry, Claire, I stole another of your case studies. But it's an interesting story. It kind of brings to the fore the challenges that bricks and mortar retailers are going through at the moment. In this
and
case,
it's wines, Majestic and Naked.
Well, so the bricks and mortar retailer in this is Majestic Wine. So their business was going okay a couple of years ago, but they were keen to expand and they wanted to build out their online capability as well. So they hit the acquisition trail and they acquired a company called Naked Wines. And Naked Wines is an online-only specialist wine retailer.
Mm, like a subscription thing.
Yeah, exactly. So you get, like, it's one of these great places, a box of wine will turn up to your house.
Christmas!
And
the money's already gone, so you don't have to think about it.
Yeah, exactly. All you got to do is drink. So they acquired Naked Wines, and in the process they through the acquisition, they have been able to expand locally in the UK, but also overseas as well. But also, it's allowed them to speed up their own digital transformation. So Majestic has previously relied a lot more on on-premise technologies, mainframe technologies, whereas Naked Wines is a born in the cloud company, as they describe it.
Mm.
And they've got quite a nifty, apparently, CRM system.
Nifty.
Which they credit with helping them build out great customer loyalty amongst their subscribers. So people, you know, they come back and they keep reordering wines and stuff like that. So that's kind of quite a big, quite a nice thing for Majestic to acquire through the acquisition.
They built this themselves?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Well, Naked did.
Yeah, so a lot they've built all of their, most of their technology in-house, like their website and everything, and they've hosted it in the AWS cloud.
Okay.
Whereas Majestic's traditionally been on-premise. So what's quite interesting here is it's a merger and acquisition, and usually a merger, well, I say usually, but it's often the case in merger and acquisition stories that the company that has acquired the other company is like, right, we need to get them onto our systems. We need them to get to work, you know, work with us and come around to our ways of working, where it's the opposite here. They have used this as a jumping off point to speed up their own digital transformation.
Yeah, but I would say in retail that that's not uncommon, especially with the amount of legacy systems that most British retailers have behind them.
Mm-hmm.
They can find it really difficult to transform digitally. So for example, John Lewis and Waitrose with their JLab program, where they work with startups each year, basically just to have a look at what's going on in the market, what technologies they could implement, and whether it could be of benefit to them. Because there's this argument as well that retailers can't really be pure play, so you can't really just operate on one channel anymore. You know, I think I first heard that from the founder of a secondhand watch reseller called Watchfinder. It was an online only brand, and he was saying they just couldn't make it work, whereas it also happens in the opposite direction. If you just have a store, it's very difficult.
The expectation is you'll be able to, oh, I know you've got a store, but have you got more stock online?
I know that you've got this, but can I do this? Customers, so fickle, so demanding.
And I guess, well, in that example as well, a watch, is, even if it's secondhand, it's still going to be quite a big purchase. So you would want to have the look and the feel, kind of what I'm actually getting for my money as well.
I want to touch it. I want to hear the sound of the ticking. Is it going to annoy me at night? That kind of thing.
Important watch buying considerations.
What are they called now? Is it Majestic Wines or Naked Wines?
Well, the acquisition was Majestic, was the Majestic group that made the acquisition. But yeah, Majestic Wine still exists, and Naked Wine still exists.
So they,
so Naked Wines is a brand within the Majestic group.
Yeah.
And Majestic Wine Warehouse, which is the bricks and mortar bit of it, is still a brand as well within it. And then they've got other, a couple of other brands as well, which we didn't get into in the case study as much. But
I would imagine it would be important for Naked Wines to keep their branding if they've worked so hard on customer loyalty anyway.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. And they're an AWS customer.
So yeah, the AWS kind of relationship with retailers, with the retail community, has been something we've I've written about this week on Computer Weekly as well, and it's really interesting. So you've got Amazon.com, which, as I mentioned earlier, was a bookseller, and now anything you could ever possibly want to buy, you could probably get on Amazon now, as long as it's legal, of course. You could get on Amazon. So there, and Amazon, the retail arm, is expanding into other areas. In the US, they've expanded into healthcare. Amazon bought Whole Foods, so they've expanded into bricks and mortar themselves.
Mm-hmm. And so, their Amazon Go stores.
Yeah, exactly. So they've gone suddenly to sort of just being an online-only retailer to possibly being seen now to be encroaching on other retailers' turf. And in some cases, these might be retailers that may have been weighing up whether or not to use Amazon's cloud services elsewhere. So what we're hearing, if you talk to Amazon about this, they're like, we've still got lots of retail customers, this, there's not a lot of unrest in the market around this and stuff like this. But we are, we've had a few stories on Computer Weekly this week and in this analysis piece where some end users have told us that they are seeing retailers maybe be a little bit more cautious about entrusting their data or spending money with Amazon.
Right.
Because they're basically funding, on the other end, could they be seen to be funding a competitor?
Very interesting. So there's a kind of backlash against AWS as such.
Yeah.
From
retailers.
Yeah. So that's a, like I said, I wrote an analysis on that this week. So yeah, but it started a few years ago. Walmart in 2017 issued some kind of guidance to their technology providers saying when you're building services for us, don't host it in AWS.
Because
really? Walmart competes with Amazon.com in other areas. And Amazon at the time sort of issued this statement, they're only like basically accusing Walmart of bullying and stuff like this. But that was kind of like one high profile example. But it's basically a retailer called Trax Retail, and they make technologies that help bricks and mortar retailers manage stock and things like that. And they said that they used to use AWS they still use AWS in some parts of their business, but they've had to diversify and start using Google Cloud now. Because some retailers are kind of like, oh, we'd rather not use Amazon Cloud ourselves, so could you make sure you're using, could you use Google as well, because they're unhappy with it.
Right.
So, yeah. And it's quite interesting, because Amazon is the world's biggest cloud company, and then in second and third place, you've got Microsoft and Google.
Mm-hmm.
Analyst reports claim that Amazon is bigger than its four biggest competitors combined.
Right.
So although Microsoft and Google are in second and third place, there's still quite a lot of catching up for them to do.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So if there's just a little chink, I think, in the armour of kind of where's somewhere we could get a competitive difference, retail could be the market for Microsoft and Google to really start eating into Amazon's market share, potentially, because of concerns from retailers.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
Yeah, it does do.
Watch,
I mean, quite
thing.
Often you hear, kind of in the enterprise analyst world, you sometimes hear people say, I mean, yes, AWS is the leader, but if you look at their customers, there's a lot of SMEs in there.
And startups
so,
as well.
So for enterprises, for big banks, big manufacturing companies, oil and gas, are they as likely to go the AWS route?
I suppose it depends, like you were saying earlier with Oracle, if they've got historic kind of leanings or existing relationships with companies in those kind of environments, in those industries, would it make sense for them to kind of keep buying Oracle and for them to think, okay, we've always used Oracle, or do we entrust someone like Amazon with our data, because, you know, they have got this consumer background and they do have more of an SME, or they've got, you know, more SMEs and startups kind of.
That would certainly be Larry Ellison at Oracle's hedge. He would say AWS is hopelessly insecure, its very architecture is insecure, and so on.
Yeah.
So that would be a kind of an Oracle point of view on that. But understand Amazon shareholders have been up in arms too.
I'd go as far as saying there's a bit of an uprising going on.
A revolution.
I think what we were just talking about there kind of alludes to something else. Amazon seems to be going through, as a company as a whole, seems to be going through a stage what a lot of big companies go through, where you have a lot of success, you get a certain size, and suddenly your activities come under scrutiny from, say, society at large a bit more, and you're suddenly on the radar of regulators a bit more, and maybe users are a little bit kind of, okay, what's going on here?
Yeah.
So in this case, what's happened is Amazon has some image and video analysis technology called Recognition, which is spelt with a K.
Recognition.
Yes. and it's not just Amazon on this. Lots of companies that make AI tools around video analysis and image recognition and things like that, there have been concerns from privacy campaigners and civil rights people about what happens if this kind of technology falls into the wrong hands, or if it's misused.
Yes.
So if this image recognition technology is used to unfairly target people from, you know, from a race perspective, so racial profiling's a big concern on this, or if it's just used to for surveillance purposes unnecessarily, or, you know, a bit overzealous surveillance, should we say, people might not necessarily require surveillance. So that's kind of something that's a concern around AI use and image recognition use.
Yes.
So what's happened is Amazon shareholders have written to the Amazon board to say, we want you to stop selling recognition, spelt with a K, to law enforcers in the US until we can have some kind of assurances that it's not being misused, or its use is being regulated in a way so there won't be any racial profiling and there won't be any kind of nefarious use of yeah. the technology.
Well, quite often these technologies have biases built into them yeah. by accident. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. People working on this technology have unconscious biases, unconscious meaning you don't necessarily know that it's happening, much like Brian earlier assuming a male instead of a female in a particular mm-hmm. role. There was research I read about on The Verge from MIT's media lab mm-hmm. that actually found facial recognition software is biased towards white male faces. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So if you're a black female, you're not necessarily going to be very much benefited
yeah, mm-hmm.
from facial recognition technology. If the government is using it and there are already these biases built into it, I can see why that would be a concern.
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't Amazon or AWS the company that got into trouble last year about AI and recruitment, where it was effectively screening out
women? I haven't heard about that, no.
Yeah.
What, within their business they were, or is it their tools?
Yeah, they had to scrap it because it was... The system was saying, well, according to my data about the kind of people we have employed.
Mm. Oh,
that's ridiculous. Mm. That's unfair.
Yeah, because it's a similar topic that came up at this Lenovo event around the data center in Barcelona. Because one area that Lenovo is really pushing into is high performance computing with AI. And they're sort of saying the use cases for that could be sort of more personalized medicine, things like that for people, or personalised financial rate interest rates given to people within financial services. But the regulation side of that, particularly on the financial services example, is what if it's shown that AI is accidentally the way they're trained through these biases you mentioned there that are put into them? What if they start giving favourable interest rates to white middle class people, whereas people of colour are discriminated against
because of
any number of factors?
Yeah.
And it's how do you guard against that happening? And they're saying that's probably, regulation is probably one of the biggest, well, in lots of industries it is, but it's probably one of the biggest hurdles to ensuring that AI will ever really reach its potential within enterprise use cases and things like that.
That and diverse teams.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we've heard what I've been up to this week, what Caroline's been up to, what Liz and Warwick have been up to. What have you been up to, Brian?
Well, I've not been anywhere.
Oh.
My trips lie in the future when I'll be on the road a great deal.
Yes.
So this week, the tables were turned in a way. I was interviewed by a researcher from Longitude, which is the Financial Times's research arm. The FT acquired this business
a wee while back. New job,
yeah, well.
And yes, this is my last day.
Oh, wow.
No, so I was interviewed about, ostensibly about autonomous databases, which is a category of technology more or less invented by Oracle to describe its database over the cloud, but there are other kind of self-healing, self-patching databases available on the market. But essentially, it was me brain dumping what I found out about data management over the past 8 years in a 40-minute interview. So that's me done on that. But that was a bit unusual to have the tables turned because I'm normally the one who's asking the questions. I've never had any media training.
It shows.
Self or
otherwise. Were you found to be useful?
Well, she really liked the interview.
Really?
Yeah. So we'll see what comes of that.
Good.
So next week I'm not going anywhere either. But I understand our networking editor colleague, Alex Scroxton, is going to be out next week in Barcelona, I think.
I think he's going to be
Cisco Live.
Yeah, out and about.
So we're hoping to pull him into this.
Yeah, get all his scoops, find out what he's learned.
Session. Yeah, what's he been up to? Any beautiful data centres? We'll see.
Adapt it.
So I think we've reached the end of this particular discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks very much, Caroline and Claire.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. Thank you very much and goodbye.